In this episode of Telemetry Now, we're joined by Christian Van der Rop, an advocate for bringing high-quality internet connectivity to remote and underserved areas around the world. He's also the creator of Connect St. Helena, an organization that eventually succeeded in bringing submarine telecommunications cable connectivity to St. Helena Island, and something that our very own Doug Madory has written extensively about. Today, Christian works primarily in the low Earth orbit communications satellite field, and both Doug Madory and I are very excited to have him on today. I'm Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Christian and Doug, thanks so much for joining today on this latest episode of Telemetry Now. And Christian, thanks so much, an honored guest, and I believe friends with Doug for quite a few years now, both professionally and I believe you've just known each other over the years. So that's really great, and I'm glad to have that connection now. As we get into today's episode, which has a lot of really interesting information, I'm looking over the outline now, and I can't wait to get into some of these details, but I would love to hear more about your personal and professional background, yes, in telecom, of course, but also maybe some of the projects and affiliations that you have right now.
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Much appreciated. What can I say? I've been a telecoms geek from the early days. I got my first modem in 1994, a 14.4K modem. So I remember the times of BBS mailboxes and dial-up internet. I still know the AT commands. So over the years, followed the development of the internet. I actually studied law, but it bought me a lot, and always looked for ways to do, you know, some sidekicks in the telecoms world. Installed networks and dormitories during university days. Then later on, went into the wholesaler internet industry. So that was involving, you know, trans-European connectivity to internet exchanges. I actually participated in the establishment of an internet exchange point in Sofia, Bulgaria, that was later taken over by Megaport, an Australian connectivity on demand provider for whom then I joined, for whom I then worked. After that, I switched more into a consultancy role and, as an independent consultant, worked on submarine cable projects. Some with success. That was the non-profit side. The for-profit side was not so successful. Maybe 6-7 years ago, switched more into the satellite industry. That was, you know, when the gold rush around the LEO constellation started. The past 6-7 years, almost exclusively on LEO constellations, and particularly on the ground segment. So that's the operational part where I've been busy, but I'm also providing, you know, strategy advice to investors in the satellite industry and also, you know, to various other organizations and startups. So, yeah, in a nutshell, I would say I'm, you know, very much interested and focused on telecoms infrastructure and, you know, bringing internet connectivity into the unconnected and underserved regions of this world.
Christian, I think you and I, I'm trying to recall, but I think you and I first got connected. I think you were working for maybe the Caucus Cable System in Georgia, or was it a Georgian?
Correct.
One of the Georgian providers.
That was Sofia Connect, a Bulgarian wholesale connectivity provider that had a exclusive arrangement with Caucasus Online, a Georgian company that owned the submarine cable across the Black Sea, and that cable got a lot of interest and traction in the days of the Islamic State when it spread through Iraq and Syria, cut many of the terrestrial fiber routes to the Mediterranean, and basically cut off entire regions of the Middle East, including the north of Iraq, Kurdistan, from their uplinks. And that is where now we basically established a new route that went from Bulgaria across the Black Sea into Georgia, Armenia, and then down into Iraq, into the Kurdistan region.
We'll be sure to post a map in the show notes for everybody getting lost in the geography here. I think you and I think we got connected because we were comparing, like, trading notes on connectivity in Iraq and Iran. You had some negotiations with Iranians. I don't have a lot of direct engagement with Iranian telecommunications folks, but
neither had I. Yeah. I have to say.
Okay.
The Kurds back in the days managed to get across Iran to the Armenian border, so we were not involved in that and never provided any services to the Iranians. That was, you know, something between the Kurdish Iraqis and the Iranians.
So how about your current projects? You know, I know you maintain, like, the Mega Constellations accounts and social media, which follows the industry of all the low Earth orbit Mega Constellations. Can you tell us about some of the stuff you work on now?
Difficult. The strict NDAs in place, so
okay. what you can't share.
I'm still working on LEO constellations, on the ground segment of one in particular. I'm working on some infrastructure projects in the telecoms data center field, and I have a couple of assignments for consultancies, small consultancy service, mostly technical due diligence for some projects.
I think we're going to circle back and really get into the LEO stuff, satellite. But before we do that, I think why don't we go through and tell the story of the submarine cable to St. Helena? So I only learned about this from you. Probably a lot of people in the world only learned about this issue from you and the organization that you founded. I wrote up a blog with a little bit of assistance from you a couple of years ago when this cable came active after 10 years of your work. It's kind of an amazing story, but do you want to set the stage here? What was the challenge?
Although you would be in a better position to tell that, because you wrote an excellent wrap-up
thanks
of the entire project with a lot of details that even I didn't remember. But yeah, essentially in, when was that, late 2011, the UK government announced that it would build an airport on the remote South Atlantic island of St. Helena, best known as Napoleon Bonaparte's last exile and place of death. And that airport would have costed, I think, close to $300 million to bring basically tourism to an island of 4,500 people and, you know, unlock economic development. At that point of time, the island was only reachable by a Royal Mail ship, the last Royal Mail ship called RMS St. Helena, and it took 5 days from Cape Town to get to the island and back, and you would only have one opportunity per month to get to the island and back to the mainland. So, yeah.
It's really almost medieval. I mean, that's 2011, but that's really a lot of us were around in 2011, and it's hard to imagine a place where you could only reach after 5 days at sea to get there.
Absolutely. So I learned about the airport and the massive investment and the plan to bring tourism to the island. And about the same week, I learned that South Africans were planning a cable across the South Atlantic called the South Atlantic Express, or ZAIX, a cable that unfortunately still has not materialized. But more out of curiosity, I wondered if there had been any efforts to lend that cable or lend a branch from that cable on the island. Because, you know, in the wider scheme, bringing tourism, unlocking economic development, and that was, you know, already back in 2011, that was 14 years ago almost, I thought, you know, without telecoms, without broadband internet access, it would be very difficult to establish high-spending tourism and promote the island and everything. And I thought a submarine cable, you know, compared to the cost of the airport is, you know, just a fraction and is... highly complimentary. So out of pure curiosity, I wrote to the South Africans developing the cable and the island government whether there were any considerations to lend that cable, and the answer was no. So I thought, you know, that needs to change, and that opportunity needs to be highlighted to, you know, the broader public and to decision makers in the UK, because Santalina is a British overseas territory and to this date totally dependent on financial grants from the motherland. So I wrote a few emails and I.
And what were they using before? Like, what were they?
So they had an Intelsat C-band connection of, I think, a megabit or something back in the days. So it was ridiculously low and remained underserved and on a very small bandwidth until the cable was activated. So yeah, the emails I sent did not result in a huge echo, a huge feedback. So I decided that opportunity needs to be promoted. So I launched a website, connectcentralina.org, unfortunately no longer reachable. Then I quickly got some media coverage in the UK, and there were some British members of parliament that suddenly got aware. There was a teacher, British teacher, that was serving on the island back in the days, Tom Greenwood. So, James Greenwood. He then launched a petition in the UK. We unfortunately did never get the 100,000 signatures required, but that basically kicked off a lot of things. And there was a parliamentary group in the UK that looks after the overseas territories. And from then on, there was quite some interest and support. The issue was, the cable did not materialize, and that dragged on for a while. Then in 2015, we had indication that there might be funding now for the cable, and then the question came how to fund it. We were talking about $10 million roundabout, and the UK government signaled readiness to fund the cable, like the initial capex, but then there would also be a significant opex, because if you have a branch from a submarine cable, you also have to contribute to the yearly operations and maintenance costs, and there's some sort of insurance in case of a cable break, that there will be a cable laying ship that comes and repairs the cable. So that cost had to be covered somehow, and the island government had no clue how to cover that cost. And again, there are only 4,500 people that do not have a huge GDP. So I had to be creative and came up with the concept of attracting satellite ground stations to the island, which obviously need a lot of backhaul capacity, fiber capacity, would become an anchor tenant on the cable, and by that help contributing to the operational cost. I have to confess, the idea is stolen from the Svalbard Islands, Norwegian archipelago in the polar circle, that got a submarine cable, actually two separate cables forming a ring, just to connect some strategic satellite ground stations up.
Really?
Up there.
Okay.
And so I offered to the island government to reach out to satellite operators, see if there was any interest to locate ground stations on the island and lease capacity on the submarine cable. Within, I think, 2 months, I had collected 15 expressions of interest. They later grew to 21 or something. And that really tipped the balance in favor of a funding decision. Things looked much rosier from that point of time. But still, the cable would not materialize. And it took then until 2018, when I heard rumors that Google was planning some cable around Africa. So I reached out to a gentleman called Andrew Metcalf, who back in the days was managing submarine cable projects for Google. And we had an interesting chat. And what I found out was that a cable from Europe down to South Africa was planned, that was later named Equiano. And Google, in a clear demonstration of social responsibility, showed readiness to lay a branch from Equiano to the island, which was much longer than what we had anticipated. So from the original cable sites, the branch would have been less than 50 kilometers. So it would have been an unrepeated cable or branch, because obviously on submarine cables you need repeaters every 60 to 70 kilometers. But for Equiano, we were talking about 1,200 kilometers for just the branch, many repeaters on that, which increased the cost dramatically. Google was ready to lend a branch, to build a branch from the island, and then the funding question came up again. Then, unfortunately, the British government backed away from their original, wasn't a commitment, but their indication that they might fund the cable. And what happened then is that the European Development Fund granted 21.5 million euros that covered the cable build. That was the last present to the island, because after that followed Brexit, and St Helena lost its eligibility to funds from the European Development Fund.
And the final kiss off from the EU to
yes,
to
yes. Right, yeah,
it's yes. Kind of a little bit of irony there.
A big kiss was that. But yeah, it took then I think another 3 years until the cable landed. It was early August 21, I think, when the cable finally landed. But it was only activated, I think, 1.5, 2 years later. On the one hand, because the cable was not completed, so they started actually the Equiano cable with a branch. So the laying campaign started on the island, and then it took another year until it was completed. And then the island government had issues with the telecoms monopolist on the island, who basically rejected to activate the cable. So, but that's a different story, and still a huge issue, the monopoly on the island, which is why people, unfortunately, still do not get the full benefits from the cable. And that manifests in the very small bandwidth they get. So the best you can subscribe to on the island is an ADSL2 connection, which gives you 10 megabits in a few cases, 15, 16 on the downlink, and just a megabit uplink. So that's very, very unfortunate, and also very frustrating for me, because I spent more than a decade on this non-profit campaign. I mean, I did this all over the years in an unpaid capacity. It was my hobby. And so that was St Helena. But one of the companies I approached when I was looking for these expressions of interest was OneWeb. And when the cable finally materialized, I pinged them and told them, look, it's now time to look for a site on the island. The cable is definitely coming. The island is not too big, and it is very rugged, very mountainous, and obviously for a LEO satellite ground station, you need a pretty good visibility to the horizon, at least to certain elevation angles, because you want to have a long pass window during which the antennas can connect to the satellites. So at that point of time, OneWeb offered me a consultancy contract, and that lasted for almost 5.25 years, I think, with a little interruption, which was the bankruptcy. That's a different story. Mm-hmm. So that bit is essentially was, so St Helena, my non-profit project, was also the driver and the reason why I shifted to the satellite industry.
Got it. So I was just pulling up the blog post that I wrote, again, with a lot of input from you and the story from you. So the cable began carrying traffic on the 1st of October, 2023. It's a couple of years back. So we had these different projects. You mentioned the SAEX, the South Atlantic Express. Sachs Cable was one that did get put in, but then it was not feasible to build a branch, or there was too late in the process for them to do a branch, and ended up being Equiano from Google. And you mentioned Andrew Metcalf. I actually just saw him in Atlanta a couple months ago, and we hung out and got to talk about submarine cables for a while, for an evening. But Yeah. So you mentioned, so this brought you into the world of low Earth orbit satellite. And I think, you know, this is a, I think most people know this through Starlink. Starlink is definitely the most famous technology here. It's not the only one. One thing I'd try to point out to people who are, you know, new to this topic is that there was satellite-based internet before Starlink. I think that's not always understood. It may not have been good, or like there's a lot of technical marvels to Starlink, but you had geostationary for decades, high latency, low bandwidth, generally high cost per megabit, and then there's medium Earth orbit, and we just have O3b is the only company that operates in that. To my knowledge, provide service. So with geostationary, you got one satellite far out in space. You just shoot to aim a dish at it. Medium Earth orbit, then you have multiple satellites, and you have a larger ground installation that has to track, have multiple dishes that are tracking multiple satellites, and you're doing these handoffs and stuff. So the complexity gets higher on the ground, and then with low Earth orbit, now you have thousands of satellites, and then the ground terminal equipment is very small. But so again, people know Starlink because that's definitely the most famous one. But there are other companies. In fact, I think something that I have so much trouble keeping up with is, you know, what is the lay of the land here? Besides Starlink and its whatever 6,000 to 7,000 satellites in orbit overhead at any given time. Who else is out there?
Besides Starlink, we obviously have OneWeb, who have completed the constellation. I think it was 23, when they went into operational service. Then we have Amazon.
When you say completed the constellation, sorry to interrupt you. When you say completed the constellation, I mean it's only a few hundred satellites, correct?
It's around about 600, yeah.
600. Is that?
They started commercial service a little bit earlier because it's a polar orbiting constellation, which means that at high latitudes you have a higher density of satellites. So they were able to start commercial service at higher latitudes, for instance, in Canada, at an earlier point. And the full constellation of around about 600 satellites was only needed then to provide near global coverage. And I'm saying near global because the issue of OneWeb is it is a bent pipe system. So the satellites have no inter-satellite links and have no regenerative payloads. So they are dependent on a gateway in line of sight of the satellite. And the gateways need to be on land with the already mentioned clear view to the sky from a certain elevation angle, and you need fiber connectivity for the backhaul. So there are unfortunately some areas in the world, including the Pacific Ocean, where there is no landmass to build a gateway. So that is why OneWeb, and with the current architecture, can never have full global coverage, something that Starlink has managed to achieve.
Do they plan to have more satellites, or can they do ISL with their satellites?
Not with the current satellites. I mean, there have been plans for a Gen 2 of OneWeb around for a while, but as we know from media, the company is in a difficult financial situation, and I'm not sure whether there will be a Gen 2, because OneWeb will be, or their parent Eutelsat will be a consortium member of the European sovereign constellation IRIS², and that is supposed to feature into satellite links. However, the big issue, and there are many of IRIS², but one of the big issues on the technical side is they're only planning gateways in Europe. So while the constellation in principle could now, when I say now, I mean 2031, 2032 at the earliest, when the satellites are supposed to be in orbit. They could, in theory, provide global coverage, but all the traffic would need to be taken back to Europe, where the gateways are. And that means you're undermining the entire latency advantage of LEO, because you will increase latency easily by, you know, 100, 200 milliseconds, depending on which region of the world you are. So I have huge doubts that IRIS² will be of any commercial relevance, particularly outside of Europe, because with the planned architecture, it is just nonsensical, and no commercial customer will subscribe to a system that ruins your latency advantage and takes all traffic to Europe. You know, we're seeing the exact opposite. Starlink are deploying gateways all over the world. They're building additional POPs, so to increase to reduce the latency, and you know, their target is like sub 20 milliseconds wherever you are in the world, and that dictates that you bring down the traffic on a gateway as close as possible and terminate it into the internet, and not, you know, take it across half the world back to your headquarters. So that's OneWeb. Again,
Ben, how about Project Kuiper from Amazon?
So Project Kuiper will have inter-satellite links from day one. That has been, you know, baked in into the design from the very beginning, and that will be a system that will resemble Starlink in its architecture a lot, including the orbital geometry.
So it's not a polar orbit. It's going to be what's the term for the?
So the initial shells will be an inclined orbit like Starlink, but just as Starlink, they will also have additional shells in polar orbit, and that is to basically cover the polar regions of the world. Because with the inclined orbits, what Starlink deployed initially, you can only cover up to a certain latitude of what Starlink was around about 53 degrees. That's the inclination. They, you know, the beams extend a little bit above that or beyond that, so you would have coverage maybe, you know, up to 55 degrees or something like that. But yeah, Kuiper will be a global system. Question is, you know, when will they launch? They are already late. So, and I don't mean yesterday's launch that was scrubbed, that would have been 27 satellites, but the first FCC milestone of bringing half of the satellites into orbit, and we're talking about, I think 1600 should be the quantity in orbit by July 26th, that it will already be almost impossible to achieve. So I wait every day that they file with the FCC for a wafer, because I don't see how they can launch, you know, and we're talking about probably 50, 60 launches until July 26.
How many satellites do they have now in orbit?
In orbit, two prototypes.
Two prototypes, okay. It's not 1,600.
No, and 27 loaded onto a rocket waiting for launch. Well, I don't know how many satellites they have already produced that, you know, might be in storage and just ready for integration onto a launch vehicle.
You know, Christian, you've mentioned a couple of times, like you mentioned some of the commercial challenges here. There's the OneWeb bankruptcy. I think it's worth calling out that in this has been a really difficult area to. There's a lot of famous companies that came and went. Iridium being one of them that tried to do this, and it's been something that people have been seeking and trying to find a way to do it. And there's been a lot of this is a high risk. There's a lot of money involved, and most of these projects don't pan out. Starlink seems to be the one that maybe has escaped, the grips of gravity to reach outer orbit here. But So how about, so there's also like, projects from China as well, is there not, like, of low Earth orbit?
Absolutely, yeah. There are two very large constellations planned. One is Guowang, also known as SatNet, and the other one would be formerly G60, known as Qianfeng, or Thousand Sails. So those are the two major players from China. A lot of resemblance to Starlink in the orbital geometry, in the design. We've just seen the first user terminal earlier this week on TikTok. So I fear that is a replica of Starlink. And the thing is, the Chinese government is very serious about it. We have just seen in the Ukraine conflict what immense value LEO constellations have on the battlefield, and I've no doubts that the Chinese will deploy these two constellations. It's a question of time. I think the bottleneck is, as for anyone else but SpaceX, the launch cadence, the launch capacity in the market, but they are making significant progress. And
how much do we know about, like, how many satellites they have in space, the Chinese constellations?
So I don't recall the exact number of the prototypes, but it's several dozens.
Okay.
I think the last launch was like 50, 60 or something, that order. So far from being able to provide any meaningful service, but I think those are also rather prototypes at this stage. So,
And they too hope to have thousands of satellites.
Correct. I mean, both constellations are in the order of 12 to 14,000 satellites. Whether they will be fully deployed is another question. I mean, there have been a lot of ridiculous filings with the ITU for constellations of hundreds of thousands of satellites. You know, rationale behind that is twofold. On the one hand, you don't necessarily know in which orbits you will exactly go when you plan a constellation like this. For the ITU filings, there is the first-come, first-served principle. So whoever files his constellation first gets the highest ITU priority. That means the following constellations, the following satellites need to basically yield to you. The trouble we have with satellite communications is with a few exemptions, and that would be Iridium and Globalstar, but there is no one that would have exclusive spectrum rights. So there are a few frequency ranges, and they are shared by all the satellite operators. That, you know, goes back to the times of geostationary satellites, where you just separated the geostationary satellites by 2 degrees on the equatorial belt, and that avoided interference. But now, you know, you have these different orbits, different orbital geometry, so the trajectories would crisscross in the sky all the time, and you have a lot of so-called inline interference events. So our inline events.
Finish your thought, please.
Interference, yeah. So that is the big trouble, and I think that would be our next topic. But the other reason why some, you know, providers have made these filings is simply, you know, psychology, scare away competitors or potential competitors, I think that's the reason behind it. But the big trouble that you have is there are rules, there are milestones. So you have to deploy a certain number of satellites after a few years. So I think after 7 years, you need to launch the first satellite. That's the bring into use. Then you have another 2 years to launch 10% of the satellites. And after another 2 years, 50% of the satellites. So those rules exist on the ITU level, and in the US there are also milestones dictated by the FCC. And if you don't launch that quantity of satellites, your filing is scaled down to the proportionate number of satellites in orbit, so the pro rata for what you were supposed to launch by that time. So that's the trouble there, and I'm not sure if the Chinese would launch the full 12,000 satellites. I think, you know, the low thousands at these altitudes should be good, and there will also be it's at some point of time increased issue with collisions and collision avoidance.
So, yeah, so I was going to ask about that. So I'm outside the space the space, so to speak. So I think we talk about it's termed these fall under the umbrella term of space safety, of things like trying to there's, you know, just the publication of the orbits and what people are doing to make sure the satellites are not running into each other. The satellites themselves have a little bit of propulsion. Is that correct? To like, if they think they're going to be on a collision course, they can adjust a little to avoid running into each other. And then like the nightmare scenario that, I don't know. I'm a lay person, so this sounds scary to me. Maybe you can put my concerns to rest. But this idea of the Kessler syndrome or Kessler effect. This is the opening scene of the movie Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. When you have a couple things run into each other, everything in orbit's moving very fast, so 17,000 miles an hour. And so when two things run into each other, even if they're very small, there's an enormous amount of momentum and they'll blow a hole through just about anything. The concern is then if you have two things crash into each other, there's all these projectiles also going something on the order of 17,000 miles an hour. Then they hit other things and hit other things. We end up like have all this debris that's all running into each other, and we just lose that, you know, area. I guess what has been told to me, explained to me, is that even though there's 6,000 satellites or 7,000 satellites in this space, if you could imagine like cars driving the surface of the Earth, something we're more familiar with, in just random directions, how often would 6,000 cars driving somewhere on the surface of the Earth, how often would they run into each other? Well, now also add the Z-axis here, so it's not just the surface; there's different depths. And so then the probability that two things run into each other becomes like starts to become very remote once you add that z-axis, and also the surface of the Earth is a smaller sphere than orbit, which would be bigger, a higher radius. So I know I've had people explain to me it sounds like a big number, but the space is just so vast that with proper coordination we can avoid two things running into each other. But that correct?
Yes, sir. I mean, the example that you gave is absolutely right. I mean, and when you look at those, you know, simulations and pictures of space debris, they're not to scale, right? So, you know, the satellites are tiny. They're not visible to the human eye, particularly on a picture that would show the entire Earth. So that's right. The issue is that even the smallest little ball, the smallest little fragment, has an enormous kinetic energy and can, you know, basically blow up any satellite, any spacecraft that it collides with. So I don't think the risk right now is humongous, but at the same time, if something happens, the debris cloud that can be released by your collision event can have a cascade effect, and in the worst case lead to the Kessler syndrome. But interestingly, right now the bigger issue is not the satellites and the count that we have in orbit. The bigger issue is the upper stages. So, you know, the upper stage of the launch vehicles. And particularly with the recent launches by the Chinese for the Qian, I'm not not sure how you pronounce it, the Thousand Sails constellation. So they released hundreds of fragments into fairly high orbits of 720 to 780 kilometers. At that altitude, it will take somewhere between 25 and 100 years for the debris to come down. So the risk is going to stay there for a long time. There's also an issue of tracking debris. So right now, the smallest kind of debris that we can see with, at least in the civilian space, are in the range of a few inches. So anything below that is right now invisible. So you cannot avoid a collision with something that you cannot see. That's certainly a growing issue. And at the same time, also the weaponization of space. So we see a lot of activity with, Stalker satellites. We are seeing studies by the Chinese that outline how you could bring down a mega constellation. And I think, those are clear messages to the Western world that they're not going to sit and wait. So, that is another risk, I think, that is underestimated. So in the next big conflict, and God forbid, but if someone decides, and there are a few powers that have the capability to do anti-satellite attacks, we might be in big, big trouble. Which is why I think we also need more diversity in terms of altitudes. So when we look at Starlink and Kuiper, they're both in fairly low orbits, both in the range of 550 to 600 kilometers. Starlink is also going into very low Earth orbit, so range of 330 to 380 kilometers. The good news is if something happens there, it will deorbit or decay naturally fairly quick. But at the same time, in case of a Kessler event or an intentional attack, we might lose a lot of capabilities in space. So that is, by the way, one of the few advantages of OneWeb, that they're at 1,200 kilometers, almost more than twice in Starlink, actually, where they might be a little bit safer from these scenarios.
All right, well, let's hope none of that comes to be. Before we run out of time, let's talk about this latest development with Starlink. I published something a couple weeks ago, again, with some of the assistance from you around these new Starlink community gateways. So I think generally people know Starlink as, I've got a little dish I put in my backyard. I'm in some rural place, and now I've got high-speed internet, and there's a lot of satisfied customers out there that couldn't get service any other way. But this is a different model, it's kind of interesting. Do you want to explain what it is?
Sure. Starlink launched the so-called community gateways, and what does it do? So, as I mentioned, Starlink has inter-satellite links. Originally, Starlink launched as a bent pipe system, just like OneWeb. That means the satellites had to have a connection to a gateway that would have been, and still is, in Ka-band. And then there is a separate antenna or a phased array antenna on the satellites that forms the beams for the user beams, or for the user links. That's in Ku-band. And the difference is essentially not only the frequency, but also the Ka-band antennas have a very focused narrow beam that is meant to go point to point, be directed to that specific ground station and or gateway, whereas the user beams, the Ku-band antennas, are meant to cover big geography and serve hundreds or thousands of customers, so point to multipoint. Now, until the time when Starlink introduced inter-satellite links, McCabe and antennas were always busy when satellites were providing service because they had to connect to the gateway. Now, with the inter-satellite links, you suddenly had satellites that were far from the gateway, so were not even able to connect to a gateway because, you know, they were beyond the horizon. And in that situation, the satellites still have connectivity to the ground, and that is through inter-satellite links to its neighbors and, you know, through a chain of neighboring satellites to the next gateway. But in that situation, the cable and antenna was suddenly idling. So Starlink basically repurposed these idling cable and antennas and put them into use by offering what they call the community gateway. So a remote community, island nations, but I just saw it, there are some places in Africa and Rwanda, I think, that now also activated Starlink community gateways. So these places link up in K-band with the big advantage that you have a lot of capacity there. So you can do 10 gigabit links versus in the Ku band, you're limited to maybe a gigabit. They're working to increase that, but there's at least an order of magnitude difference between the achievable bandwidth in Ku over K-band. The trouble is only that for community gateways, or in order to use the K-band gateway links, you need pretty large and sophisticated antennas. So that would be mechanically steered antennas put in a radome. They look exactly the same as in the Starlink gateways. They're probably actually the same antennas. And you need four of them. So the cost of a community gateway is $1.2 million, at least that's what the Starlink website says. And they charge, was like, I think, $50,000 per gigabit a month. So not affordable to you and me, but you know, for an island community, it is definitely interesting. I think it is in many cases cheaper than what we did in Santa Elena, lending a submarine cable. And it is much easier and quicker to deploy. I mean, that's something you can probably ship and install in a few weeks, whereas a submarine cable takes years to be completed. But that also means, you know, Starlink from being a last mile service is now becoming an aggregator. It's a middle mile service, and potentially it you know, could become part of the global internet backbone. So I don't think there is or Starlink's going to carry half of the world's internet traffic, as Musk in one of his early talks about Starlink said. So that's nonsense, because you will never be able to achieve bandwidths anywhere close to what you can do in a fiber optic cable. I think it will play an increasingly important role, particularly for remote communities. But I also see the mega constellation Starlink and Kuiper providing connectivity to other satellites and other spacecraft. So that's something Starlink has already been experimenting with that recent Dragon mission. So the crewed capsule was connected through laser links to the next Starlink satellites, and that's how they maintained connectivity, high bandwidth connectivity, while they were in orbit. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's very interesting what's happening there, because
they just put a dish by the window and point it in the general direction.
Right. So these are quite expensive. So easily $250,000 US dollars. They're basically a gimbal type of thing with sophisticated pointing mechanisms inside, and they need to work very, very precisely. But they can do 100 gigabits. That's at least what Starlink claims today, and what other LCT manufacturers promise. And that is a very interesting technology, and something that I'm convinced will proliferate over the coming years. And
I wonder if we're ever going to have a data center that exists in orbit.
I'm not too sure if that makes a lot of
okay.
sense. I think
maybe
we're
not.
At least a decade away from that. Although they got arguments, including the power available in space. So if you had a very large solar
cold
arrays in space, you could. But then if you need to replace a component or something, that might get difficult up there.
All right. Well, I want to be mindful of your time. I know you only have so much time to spend with us, but it was super interesting hearing your explanations for this stuff. Phil, do you have any comments?
Comments? Yeah, I really like that whole data center in orbit thing you just brought up. You know, with regard to cooling and power and stuff. That's an interesting one. With all the talk about data centers now. Especially, but no, this has been great, Christian. So thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you too. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to your next episode. I'm a loyal listener, and
absolutely awesome. Great. So if you have, to our audience, if you have an idea for a show or you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us at telemetrynow@kentuck.com. So for now, thanks so much to our guests for joining us today. And thanks so much to our audience for listening. See you next time.